From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how the environment surrounding both fitness trackers and workplace wellness programs could change in the near future.
Plus, Rachel Morello joins us for our regular education quiz, and we'll look at some of the fine feathered friends that visit Wisconsin during the winter.
We do notice, you know, the lack of birds as they migrate south, but for some birds, Wisconsin is south for them.
And later, singer-songwriter Tift Merritt has written hundreds of songs, but suddenly she's getting noticed for her new work in textiles.
You know, it's a return to unknowing. It's a return to being at the beginning, which, you know, if you can do that every time you make something, that's really wonderful. So it was a little like sending off super early demos and having somebody be like, oh my gosh, that's good.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Mobile wellness devices, the Fitbit, the Apple, or Garmin watch, are ubiquitous these days. Many of us wear them with the goal of holding ourselves accountable for our physical fitness.
They're also becoming a tool that employers are using with a separate but related goal, having healthy employees and controlling healthcare costs.
But the devices themselves are evolving and may soon make more promises than just counting your steps or keeping track of your heart rate.
And that means they could face a different kind of regulation than what governs them today. It's a topic that contributor Barbara Zabawa wrote about recently for the American Bar Association. Zabawa is the owner of the Center for Health and Wellness Law and a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Welcome back to the show. Great to see you.
So glad to be here, Mitch.
A lot of people have fitness trackers and other mobile health devices. I have a relatively basic one on my wrist. It counts my steps. It's supposed to measure my sleep, my activity level, the calories I burned. Other people have them integrated into a smartwatch. I think you may have one of those right now.
I do.
What is happening in this industry that makes it about more than people getting a fitness tracker for Christmas and keeping track of their activity?
Yes, well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk with some wellness devices, that's what I call the Apple Watch and Fitbits and things like that, moving into more of a clinical use. So treating chronic diseases or conditions or trying to help prevent those conditions. And when wellness devices move in that direction, they just have to be more aware of the fact that they may be subject to FDA regulation, because FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, regulates medical devices. And medical devices are loosely defined as those devices that are aiming to treat or prevent disease. And so when you move away from just being a wellness device and a lifestyle kind of device, and into more of a treatment realm, then you could be subject to FDA regulation. And so that's just something that not the consumer needs to worry so much about. It's more for the manufacturer and the distributor of those devices that they'll need to be concerned about FDA regulation.
When it comes to regulation, does it make a difference whether these are consumer-driven or employer-driven reasons for wearing these devices? I mean, let's say, you know, I have a Fitbit and, you know, I'm basically using it to keep track of my steps. Does it make a difference if, you know, my doctor is asking me to wear it or my employer demands that I wear it as part of a wellness program?
Not really. What determines whether the FDA will get involved in a device is the intended use, and the intended use has to be related to treatment of disease or other illnesses, or you know, trying to prevent diseases. And you know, a lot of these devices do in effect do that, but the intended use really is for keeping track of your steps, as you mentioned, or smartwatches, checking your email, and there's a lot of other functionalities that take place. I mean, they also do check your heart rate, but I don't think that's the intended use of the device. You know, it's to to keep track of, you know, if you're going to have a heart attack. So,
well, and I gather companies like Fitbit are increasingly seeing themselves as less about individual consumers and more as players in the larger healthcare field.
Yes. Well, I think they have some desire to move into that field. It's a field full of a lot of money, and it's, you know, obviously 18% of our gross domestic product nationally. So it's quite a huge industry, and there are a lot of things that industry can do to improve outcomes, improve the health of the population. And so it makes sense that they may be looking to, you know, move out into the clinical world, but that's when the FDA comes into play, and that's just something that they need to be cognizant of, and that's what I wrote in a recent article for the American Bar Association.
Well, right, and so presumably the FDA has these regulations in place for the benefit of all of us. Beyond knowing that they're regulations, what are the kinds of things when it comes to medical devices that the FDA involves itself in?
So it's regulating, you know, it wants those devices to be registered, first of all. And ultimately, what it cares about is safety, consumer safety. So when you get into more of the clinical realm, the devices are going to, you know, maybe be more invasive, or you're going to be making claims about, you know, being able to cure or prevent. And the FDA is going to step in and make sure that what you say it will do that as safely and won't harm consumers. I mean, because that's what they care about. They don't want any device or drug, because they regulate drugs, to out in the marketplace that will hurt the consumer or give them a false belief in something.
Right. This is like the difference when we see in TV commercials between, you know, what's a medicine and what's a nutritional supplement. And, you know, obviously the disclaimer on it that this product is not intended to treat, diagnose, or cure any disease.
Yes, right. It's a great observation.
And so presumably the same could be said for these wellness devices, especially as they develop down the road and the FDA gets more involved.
Right. I mean, so the FDA just came out actually last month with a revised guidance about wellness devices and mobile apps. I mean, there are a lot of apps out there that you can use for nutrition, for exercise, and things like that. And the FDA said that for wellness-type devices, they are not going to either consider them medical devices at all, which means they aren't, they don't fall within its regulatory authority, or if they are, they could be considered medical devices, they aren't going to enforce their regulations against those devices. And they have a list that they came up with of things or similar things that they would not enforce. They would use their enforcement discretion, or that they would not consider medical devices at all. And that my article kind of goes into that as well.
You write that there are some recent examples of how companies who saw themselves in one part of the industry didn't play by the regulatory rules as they expanded into other parts of the healthcare world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's easy to get used to a more loose, regulated industry. And then when you move into a more regulated industry, which is what healthcare is, to kind of get lost or forget or not realize that you've kind of stepped into that realm.
You also write that wellness program incentives, this is a good transition because I know at one point in the history of the wellness program that we have here, it resulted in getting a fitness tracker. You write that wellness program incentives by employers could become a thing of the past.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot of buzz about that possibility. And what prompted that buzz was a recent court decision by the District of Columbia District Court in the AARP v. EEOC case. So the AARP sued the EEOC back in 2016 about the EEOC's rules under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
A lot of letters here.
Yes. And the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. The EEOC came up with some rules under those two laws that said employers can impose incentives, financial incentives, to encourage employees to give up their personal health information, usually through a health risk assessment or a biometric screen. So if you work for a company that asks you to fill out a survey about your health or asks you to give blood so they can figure out your glucose or cholesterol levels, they may give you some monetary reward for doing that. And the EEOC said in its rules that they could do that. The AARP disagreed and said, you know, a lot of employees, especially those with lower incomes, may not be able to afford that incentive. And you're therefore compelling them, forcing them to give up their personal health information. And we think that's against the law, the ADA in particular. So they sued and they won. And the court in December of 2017, just a month ago, basically said that the EEOC had to rewrite those rules. And one of my predictions is that the EEOC is going to have a hard time finding an incentive amount that all employees, regardless of their income, would feel would still be a voluntary wellness program.
So this is the idea, like an employer offers a certain amount of money to go through a biometric screening or mm-hmm. what have you, and the only people who feel comfortable saying, no, I don't need that, are the ones who are financially well off to begin with.
Yeah, right. So the lower income employees may feel like they can't. That's money. That's significant amount of money that they would lose, or they might have to pay a significant amount more for their health insurance. So they feel like they have no choice but to take the health risk assessment or go through the biometric screen. And the ADA states that, you know, if employers are going to collect that information, it has to be voluntary. And so if you start putting money into this HRA, as they call it, or biometric screen, then it may no longer feel voluntary for a lot of employees. So the EEOC has to go back to the drawing board and figure out, well, what amount of money would all employees feel that it was a voluntary activity? And I think they're going to have a hard time coming up with a number. And they have to do it later this year. And the current rules are no longer going to be in existence as of January next year. So employers, many may feel like they don't want to bother with the incentives. I also think that many employers will still pursue incentives and use other legal avenues to do that. And we can get into that some other time. but it's certainly going to be a rocky year.
Right. I think your provocative headline says we're back to the Wild West.
Yes. It's going to be there's a lot of disruption in the employee wellness marketplace right now.
Well, and so for consumers who, you know, work for employers who have these programs in place, they are still in place for the current year, right? We're talking about 2019 at this stage.
2019, the rules that are in place right now will no longer be in place. Something else maybe, or maybe nothing, which, again, the Wild West. So it'll be an interesting year. 2018 is turning out to be a very interesting year in that way.
Seems like it is always an interesting year to be a health and wellness lawyer.
That's right. Never a dull moment.
Well, Barbara Zabawa, thank you so much for helping us understand these things.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and owns the Center for Health and Wellness Law. She's also a regular health policy contributor to Lake Effect, and you can find links to our past interviews with her and her recent article we referenced at WUWM.com.
Education reporter Rachel Morello gives me a midterm on the latest education headlines from around Wisconsin and the country when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. After the recent holiday break, students, teachers, and staff have returned to Wisconsin's classrooms to finish the second half of the school year.
Returning along with them is WUWM's Rachel Morello, back with another round of our education news quiz that we call Passing Notes. She's here to test how closely I've been following education headlines. Happy New Year, Rachel.
Hey, thanks. Same to you. Let's hope the holidays were restful for kids, because some of them are coming back with semester exams in front of them.
I have a daughter who is just going through such a thing on Thursday.
Nice. But even for those who aren't coming back with tests, there's still plenty happening in the hallways, so we have a lot of ground to cover. Are you ready for your first quiz of the new year?
As the kids say, ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, good. So this week we've got a news item from the national scene, one on the state level, and one a little more local. So we'll start right here in Milwaukee and work our way up. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay. So there's a proposal making its way through the rulemaking process at the Milwaukee School Board. That's the group that governs MPS. And the proposal recommends eliminating something students currently have to do. Can you guess what that is? Is it A, participating in science fair, B, paying student fees, or C, pretty on topic here, taking semester exams?
I'll qualify this by saying this is a complete guess. I am going to say B.
B, student fees?
Yes.
You are correct. So student fees are basically any fees that students pay for extracurricular activities, graduation, athletics, driver's ed, things like that.
Field trips?
Field trips. Anything on top of, you know, baseline going to school, tuition, stuff like that. And this is something many school districts do, even public school districts. It's also something colleges usually do. And Michael Bonds, who's one of the directors on the Milwaukee School Board, has proposed getting rid of these fees altogether. He says based on district demographics, the additional money is an added burden for many MPS families. He originally brought his idea to the board's finance committee back in the fall, and they tabled discussion to the new year. They were supposed to take it up at their meeting earlier this week. I spoke to board administration, and they told me they'll likely take it up at their meeting in February. So it's something that seems like it warrants a little bit of extra research and discussion even before it gets discussed out in public.
All right. So I'm one for one in my midterm.
You are. You are. Your semester exams are going very well. Okay. So now we'll go up to state-level news. And this one involves Governor Scott Walker and some of the Republicans in the state legislature back to work on school budgets. They announced this week that they're working on a deal to send more money to a specific subset of schools. Which schools are those? Are they A, rural schools, B, magnet schools, or C, Milwaukee public schools?
I'm going to say rural schools.
A, rural schools. You would be correct again. Very good, Mitch. So some of Wisconsin's rural districts tend to have issues with enrollment because their districts are so sparsely populated, and that can also lead to issues with low revenue.
Districts that often have to merge because of such low enrollment.
Right. And this deal being crafted in the State House would make more financial aid available to those schools. It basically would bump up the amount of state money per student by $100. Right now they get $300 per kid. And this deal would bump it up to $400. And this might have implications for property taxes, as you might imagine, in those districts. So not all lawmakers are on board. And we'll have to wait and see what kind of wheeling and dealing happens, if any, to push this proposal through. Because right now it seems like it's a push-pull between the Assembly and the Senate.
And we shouldn't overlook the fact that this is also an election year.
That is right. Okay, so you're two for two. And last but not least, we've got this national level question. Have you ever seen those calendars that have national celebrations on them, like Ice Cream Day or Hug Your Mom Week or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. January marks a big national celebration for an education-related cause. Is it A, National Lunch Lady Appreciation Week, B, National Humanities Day, or C, National School Choice Week?
I've got to go with National School Choice Week. I would love for it to be Lunch Lady Appreciation Week, and so would the lunch ladies, I'm sure.
Everyone appreciate your lunch lady. You're correct, it is School Choice Week. That runs from January 21st to the 27th, and here's how Choice Week President Andrew Campanella describes the festivities.
The goal of National School Choice Week is to let parents know that they have choices when it comes to their children's education. There are so many different types of schools now. We're talking about all options: traditional public schools, public charter schools, public magnet schools, online academies, private schools, and homeschooling. So many different types of programs to give parents more access to a good education for their kids. And during National School Choice Week, we want people to learn more about the options they have in their community.
And Mitch, as you may know, Wisconsin is home to one of the longest running school choice or voucher programs in the country, right here in Milwaukee. And as folks around town gear up for Choice Week, I actually have a challenge I want to give to parents.
Okay, how can parents take part in this?
Well, I want to hear about why they chose the school that they did for their kid or their kids. Whether it was a public school, a private school, religious, voucher, homeschool, whatever the case, I want to know what factors go into making that kind of decision. So I'm asking parents to send me the sound of their own voice using their smartphone.
And that is not always an easy task for everyone.
It's not. So we're actually going to put a brief tutorial about how to do so on the website. I'm also taking submissions on social media, WUWM's Facebook page, Twitter account, any way parents want to send me their story. I want to hear it anytime within the next week, and maybe their submission will appear in an upcoming story.
Sounds spectacular. They can find all this out at WUWM.com.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. You can read more of her coverage on our website. That's also where you can submit your questions about learning and education in southeastern Wisconsin. It's all online at WUWM.com/education.
Another short break, and then a look at some of the birds that flock to Wisconsin for its wintry weather. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. As winter descends on Wisconsin, the cold sets in, our fair weather and fair feathered friends often take an extended vacation down south.
But as many of Wisconsin's native birds leave for warmer weather, another group of birds begins to make its home in frost-laden forests and prairies around this state.
Lindsay Obermeyer is the manager of the Raptor Program at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. Lindsay, thanks so much for speaking with me here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I think there's this common misperception that, you know, wintertime comes and then all the birds leave. But as I was doing some research into this, it seems like there are actually some birds that come into our area during the winter.
This is correct. Yeah, and it's actually surprising. We do notice, you know, the lack of birds as they migrate south. But for some birds, Wisconsin is south for them. And so, yeah, they come down here. They can be seen in our bird feeders. They can be seen in big fields. And we can keep our eyes just as peeled in the winter as we do during the summertime.
What kinds of birds end up coming into Wisconsin for the winter?
So we'll find a lot of birds that are more from northern Canada and the Arctic. Even smaller birds like purple finches and red poles, pine siskins will come in. So these are little birds we can continue to feed at our feeders. And then the ones that really get a lot of attention are the larger birds that are much more noticeable, like our raptor friends. So our raptors, when we say that, I'm talking about hawks and owls and like eagles and falcons. Those are what we consider raptors. And especially in the wintertime, one of the most popular raptors that comes into Wisconsin is the snowy owl, because they're so strikingly beautiful. So they come and visit us, as well as northern harriers, rough-legged hawks, and we can enjoy seeing them here while they spend their winters with us.
One of my colleagues was actually saying that he and his son had seen about 3 snowy owls this winter, and that's part of why we're having this conversation.
Yeah. We are in the middle of a very large eruption year for snowy owls. And so when I say that, the word eruption, we can think of it as invasion almost. So these birds aren't necessarily migrating like our sandhill cranes would migrate. It is actually tied to a high food availability during the breeding season in the Arctic. So this past summer, snowy owls had a lot of food up there. They really like to eat lemmings, which are a small rodent. So there were a lot of lemmings, which means that the adult breeding snowies were able to produce more chicks. So what happens then, when it's wintertime like now, those first-year birds have to leave because there's no territory for them to find food. So they will come and visit us here in Wisconsin. We have such a large number this year. The last number that I heard were 200 individuals of snowies in Wisconsin. They've actually been seen in 63 of our 72 counties in the state. Very high numbers. And it's exciting to see it. It happens about every 4 years.
How many counties around Milwaukee have they been seen in?
Almost all of them, yeah. If you want to think about where these birds are going to be found, it's pretty much open landscapes. So think about where they are, where they can live in the Arctic, large open spaces. They'll be found in grasslands, open marshland, and here in the along the lakefront. A couple come down and hang out here in downtown Milwaukee, where they can look over the lake, and there's large areas to look. And these are the areas that they'll prefer. So as long as, you know, they have that and they can hunt appropriately, they'll hang out in those areas.
What is it about Wisconsin during the winter that makes it attractive to both the songbirds and the raptors?
That's a very good question. we see our winter birds primarily because we fall just right in that pathway of them. They can just continue to follow things south until they find habitat that's suitable for their food, especially these smaller songbirds who during the summertime will eat insects and seeds. They'll come down here and continue to eat our seed. But they come down to Wisconsin. They're also found like along the East Coast, the New England area. But we have these large expansive lands, farmlands, where especially like our raptors can continue to find their prey, their rodents that they need, and they prefer to they prefer to be here. Maybe they like the Packers. You know, they're Packer fans.
Big Packer fans. Yeah. Are there any local birds or birds that we think of as being local in spring and summer that do winter over and are still active in Wisconsin?
Oh, most definitely. There's just few of them. What they're actually finding with some raptor populations that used to be migrants, which means that every winter they would leave. Some of our raptor populations, like our peregrine falcons and our American kestrels, they'll actually stay here now because they are able to find their food. As long as a bird or an animal in general can find food and it has proper shelter, it wants to stay where it lives. So so we can see, like these raptors, we can see red-tailed hawks throughout the year. Our bald eagles stay here throughout the entire year. We can just see them kind of using different areas depending on where the food availability is.
So if you're someone who is brave enough to venture out into the cold in Milwaukee or the kind of surrounding areas and you know, go bird watching, where should you go?
If you're brave enough, and there are many of us out there that are, it depends on what you're looking for, really. And a great way to go birding in the winter is by using your own vehicle as your birding blind. So here in Milwaukee, I mean, you can go down to the ferry, stay in your car, and see what kind of raptors and water birds, shore birds you can see. But there are other areas. So the Buena Vista grasslands are another place. A lot of our natural areas, like Horicon Marsh, you want to kind of just check out these natural national and state parks, and that's where you can see these guys. And you can sit in your car, stay warm, sip your coffee, and go birding.
All right. Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for coming and speaking with us about birds in winter in the Milwaukee area. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Obermeyer is the Raptor Program Manager at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. The Nature Center hosts its own day of winter hiking and bird watching on January 28th, where you can meet their resident snowy owl named Windchill McLeod. For information and to see photos of Mr. McLeod, head to WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then talk with musician Tift Merritt in a time of transition for the singer-songwriter. A performance and conversation when Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Singer-songwriter Tift Merritt has made records for more than 15 years. She first got widespread notice with the album Bramble Rose, and while her music has won her fans and critical praise, her latest album emerged at a time when Merritt found herself at a new juncture in life.
Merritt became a mom a little more than a year ago, and the transition naturally has led to some soul-searching. Merritt was in Milwaukee in the fall for a concert at Shank Hall and joined us in the performance studio and shared some music, including this song called Wait For Me.
Wait for me. Above her knees, she sings, wait, wait for me. You gotta do right by your lady, and you gotta do right by your dreams. I wanna do right by my baby, and my baby wanna do right by me. Oh, my baby wanna do right by me. Oh, my baby wanna do right by me. Oh, wait for me.
Tift Merritt in the Lake Effect Performance Studio, Wait For Me. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a thrill to have you here.
Thank you.
I had all sorts of questions I was going to ask you to start. And, you know, there's always a lot of pressure on that first question.
Oh, yeah.
But I was watching you sitting here watching you play, and the first question that really occurred to me to ask is about your really cool-looking guitar. Which sounds kind of shallow. But.
No. Guitars, you know, nothing about cool guitars is shallow. Because, you know, cool guitars have soul. This is a 1964 Hummingbird that a guitar shop where I'm from called me when it came in from the North Carolina mountains. Had been sitting in somebody. They said, you know, a woman whose husband had passed away. It had stayed in a closet for a really long time. And it's a Hummingbird, which I've always wanted a Hummingbird. You know, all the girl singers in the 70s had doves or Hummingbirds. It has this very feminine inlay on the pickguard. And sometimes they can be really tinny, but this one has a lot of warmth and depth. So it was kind of my dream guitar. And a lot of people don't take their nice guitars on the road, but gosh, I don't, you know, that's like having a pretty dress and not wearing it, so.
You said the guitar shop where you're from, and I was going to ask about that because
yeah.
I think if I have my Tift Merritt chronology right, you've been from North Carolina.
Maybe you can help me with it.
And Texas and Paris for a while.
Yeah.
And I think the last time we talked, it was via Skype, and you were in your apartment in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where are you from?
I'm from North Carolina. I mean, you know, I have a lot of other places that are dear to my heart. But I'm from North Carolina, and I have that kind of very rooted, gnarled relationship with my roots where, you know, it just goes really, really deep. You know, it doesn't mean that it's Paris or Rome or anything like that, but it's where I'm from. And I actually moved back when I had my daughter so that I could be close to my parents and have things be simple for her. And we live right near this old graveyard that I bike through with her a lot. And my grandparents are buried there. And, you know, I realize that I have heard of most of the people in that graveyard, or, you know, they knew my grandparents or my mother went to school with them, or, you know, there's this, I know where the street that's named after that fam, you know, it's just, and I think, you know, my original person, it like feels really hemmed in by that. But I think it getting realer with it, that's a really special kind of depth. that isn't always around these days.
I want to turn back to your most recent album. I guess the last time we spoke in person, yeah, we were talking about this was 10 years ago.
That's really weird. You look the same.
It's amazing because once you lose most of your hair, it's forever gone.
You look exactly the same to me, so.
Well, and you look the same to
I
me,
do
too.
I do not.
Did you see yourself – are you still in touch with where you saw yourself in the music world 10 years ago?
No. No. I mean, I mean, that's an interesting day to ask me that question, but no, not at all. I mean, my life has gone in a really – in some unexpected ways. So, you know, I mean, the music industry is just really different. So, you know, even if my – feelings about it hadn't changed. It is different. So,
are you at the point where do you like? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you know, when you're a younger person in any field, you kind of have a certain set of expectations for what the field. I don't know that it owes you anything, but what you expect to get from the field, and when you get older, do those expectations go away?
You know, I mean, I think that's – I think it really depends on your experience. And, you know, I don't think that we should ever stop hoping and dreaming, you know.
I wondered if expectations get replaced with more subtle hope or dreams.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm really in a transition. I have a lot of questions. I mean, honestly, you've caught me at probably a good time to be interviewed because I haven't been doing very many interviews. And, you know, I'm thinking a lot about all of this. I'm in my 40s now. I have a child. I never really turned a corner in the music business. So I can't really go around the world playing to 150, 200 people. I just can't. It's not economically feasible. It's not physically feasible. And so that, you know, that's – I don't think that that's going to change. So you kind of have to say, okay, let's get real about this. And, you know, I think for me, being an artist was never something I wanted to do as a hobby. But I might have to. You know, I might have to do it on the side. And I'm kind of this – full-on person that doing anything on the side is not in my nature. But I also feel really confused by the world at this moment. And I really feel very confused about what our culture is mirroring. I feel really confused about the state of our government and the state of the world. And I feel like pop culture is a little bit indulgent and trying to take up space in the world of so much content it makes me uncomfortable. I hate social media. I feel like it's, bragging, and I was raised very much that you didn't do that. So, you know, I think maybe it isn't my place anymore. Maybe the world needs something different from me, and I'm just trying to listen really carefully to what that might be, and it may just be Gene's mom.
Well, I wondered if having this other important role, it crowds out these other things, but it allows these other things to take on smaller places while still giving you something important to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, I've always... I was always a little afraid of being a mom because I really like being a grown-up and I really love, you know, working and writing and time by myself. And I thought, what if I become a mother and the conflict between those two things is really severe and it doesn't make me happy and then I'll feel like the worst person the world has ever known. And also just... putting economic pressure on your work is always scary for anyone in any field. But being a mother just has been the best thing that ever happened to me. And I really, you know, it sounds a little trite, but I thought that I was a musician, but I'm actually a mom. I think that there's more music and poetry in my life now than there ever has been. And you kind of feel the bottom drop in ways that, you know, in the best moments in music, playing music, you do feel the bottom drop and you feel affirmed and you feel moved and like life is bigger than the moment you were in. But, you know, I feel that pretty much all day, every day with Gene. So whatever else happens kind of doesn't matter quite so much.
And there's no way to I don't want to sound condescending when
please,
I say this.
Please, tell me you told me so.
No, but. But those questions that you were talking about, you know, this feeling like, you know, I'm a grown-up and I like this time to myself and you know, am I going to be essentially the same person or is this all going to be lost when I have a child?
Yeah.
I want to say there's not a parent in the world that hasn't asked that before their child is born, but I know there are parents that haven't asked that. But I think for a lot of us, I mean, you're definitely not alone in thinking about that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's interesting because Gene's been with me on the road all this year, and I don't know that we're going to do that a whole lot more, at least for the time being. But there are a lot of really good things about it. You know, for all you musician moms out there, I mean, you don't cook, you don't do laundry. There's a finite amount of stuff to throw around. You know, that sort of home containment cycle of you put it up, they pull it off. You clean it, they mess it up. You clean it, they mess it up. You know, like you kind of get away from that on the road. And that's, I think, been something that's been really special to me.
I have lots more questions I want to ask you.
Please.
But I'll ask you this question first. Do you have another song you might want to share with us?
I want to play this one. It's called My Boat. It's based on a Raymond Carver poem. My boat, it's being made to order. Right now it's with the builder. My boat, my friends. Room on board for my friends. I'm serious about this. My boat. George, Gary, Chuck, and Jim. Room enough for all of them and my baby on my boat. No one will be tonight on my boat, on my boat. No getting ahead, falling behind on my boat, on my boat. Just having a real good time on my boat, on my boat, on my boat, on my boat. Stories, room on board for stories, my own and everybody's going on and on. Short ones, true ones, and the made-up ones still being written on my boat. Cherries, chicken, cheese, and wine. Everything good in my friend's like and my baby on my boat. No one will be. Getting ahead of falling behind on my boat, on my boat. Just having a real good time on my boat, on my boat, on my boat, on my boat. Eating and laughing down on my boat. You just do whatever you want. on my boat. We may go a little ways down the coast. We're gonna listen to the rolling stones on my boat. Always wanted a trip like that. If it don't work out, no one will be tonight on my boat, on my boat. You're getting it falling behind on my boat, on my boat. Just having a real good time on my boat, on my boat. No one will be tonight on my boat, on my boat, on my boat. On my boat, my boat is being made to order. Right now it's with the builder. My boat.
I think that is my favorite song on that album.
Oh, you do?
I love
you know,
that song.
I think it might be mine too. And I just felt like that was such a, you know, When I wrote it, I mean, I didn't write the words. Obviously, Raymond Carver wrote the words, and they're beautiful. And I thought, no getting ahead or falling behind on my boat was just such a wonderful way to describe decent human relationships, you know, or decency. And you know, all of a sudden, all these things happened, and I think it's really important to say nobody will be denied on my boat, and that's like what life is about and what this country is supposed to be about too. So
do you ever reflect on the luxury, I don't know that it's a luxury, okay, but on the luxury of being able to have the gift of expressing yourself musically when you have a child?
You know, I think there's no one in the world that will remind you how small you are more than your child. And, that really does not come into play because I don't sing to her in any kind of showy way. I mean, maybe I don't sing to you in any kind of showy way either, but one of my first truly distinct memories of music was hearing my mother sing this lullaby, "Go Tell Aunt Patsy the Old Gray Goose Is Dead," and she'd sing it really low and soft. And she thinks she has a terrible voice. You know, she thinks she's the least musical person in the world. And that's like one of my most treasured musical memories, is my mother singing off key to me. So I will say, well, one night Jean would not go to sleep. And she's been on the road a lot. So she knows the ins and outs of a gig. You know, she knows that the chords get plugged into the amp and the guitar and all that kind of stuff. And she climbed into her baby's cradle, and I started to sing her to sleep, thinking that, oh, maybe we got it. And she closed her eyes, and I thought maybe we were getting there, and then she opened them at the end of the song, and she clapped. I thought, oh, my God, I'm screwed.
I can't let you go without asking about this, but, and I think this is the first time I've gone down this road in a music interview, but I do want to ask about your textile work.
Oh, thank you very much.
How did that interest come about?
Well, you know, I'm a textile junkie. You know, I buy wool blankets at flea markets and scarves and handkerchiefs, and then I started getting into vintage ribbon. And I didn't know what to do with it, and I started sewing it onto guitar straps, onto leather, and making my own guitar straps. And it just so happened that I have a really old friend who has a furniture company that he recruits people from other mediums to do design projects. And I never, ever, ever said, hey, don't you think I should do something? But
did you think it?
Yeah, I had my fingers crossed. But I was nervous, too, because he works with just amazing, amazing, amazing people, many of whom I've met through our friendship. So I, you know, he asked me to if I could try to do some textile designs, and I just happened to be 8 months pregnant, and I didn't know how to even begin. But I went to a Xerox machine and started experimenting with patterns with all these beautiful ribbons and textures that I had with the leather and the, you know, the pock marks and the needles. And just a song is the same thing with a song. Like a song is the instrument and the feelings and the way it is in your hands. And, you know, that process is it's just feel. So I just kind of tried to do that visually with this Xerox machine and a bunch of old ribbon. And then they took it to the mills and we experimented with different colors, and it was a really fascinating process. You know, I don't by any stretch of the imagination think that, you know, I'm going to get to go like make textiles for a living, but it was a really, really, really wonderful project and wonderful people involved and, you know, really wonderful to make something beautiful in that way that kind of stands on its own. And I don't really know what success or failure is in terms of sales in the furniture world, you know. So maybe
you don't get a gold chair.
I
called.
I said, you know, I'm happy to do this, but I've never been a commercial success at anything in my life. So.
Well, I overthink outros here, but I'm going to say Jean is lucky to have you.
Thank you so much. That's about the nicest thing you could say.
And we are lucky to have you, too.
Thank you.
What would you like to play us out with?
I'm going to play a song called Love Soldiers On. Bruised up and skinny as a stray, no one I've known so underpaid. Been around the block.
Tift Merritt playing in the Lake Effect Performance Studio recently. Her latest album is called Stitch of the World. Our in-studio performance and conversation was engineered by Jason Reavy. You can see pictures from the in-studio session and hear all three songs she played at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Joy and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Bonnie North, and Mayan Silver. We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and Rachel Morello, plus web support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from Jason Reavy.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.
Love, soldiers on. Love, soldiers on. There's nothing you can do. Love will soldier on. All in all.